This is January 25th, 2009, and I'm going to discuss leadership and optimism and hope from a Buddhist perspective. This has been a remarkable week, of the inauguration of Barack Obama as president. In an interview on the night of the inauguration day, Ken Burns was asked how he would see that day, inauguration day, on a scale of 10 being the equivalent of Lincoln's inaugural address, or maybe it was Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, where he would rate last Tuesday, and he said he would make it 11. He saw it as he said as the third act in American history. The first being Jefferson signing the Declaration of Independence. The second being the Lincoln thing. And this now being the third, I don't think it's an exaggeration what he said. I think it's, you could argue that this has been the most important week in American history, other than those other two. So there is everywhere. I'm sure. Others have noticed this. There is enormous upwelling of optimism and hope, and in our country now, in the world, and so that's why I wanted to examine what's going on here, and how we can work with this moment of time. I want to start by reading. I won't quite start. I'll just say a few things. There's a lot in American culture about optimism. All right. I'll just start reading this article. This is by Barbara Ehrenreich, beautiful writer, and this is from a September article in the New York Times, and they give it the title, The Power of Negative Thinking. And this is how she begins. This was, of course, well before the election, the presidential election. And she's, it was just when we were starting to see that something terribly wrong was starting to happen in the financial markets and the mortgage markets. She starts, greed and its crafty sibling, speculation, are the designated culprits for the financial crisis. But another much admired habit of mind should get its share of the blame, the delusional optimism of mainstream all-American positive thinking. The emphasis here is on delusional optimism. As promoted by Oprah Winfrey, scores of mega church pastors, and an endless flow of self-help bestsellers, the idea is to firmly believe that you will get what you want, not only because it will make you feel better to do so, but because visualizing something ardently and with concentration actually makes it happen. You will be able to pay that adjustable rate mortgage, or at the other end of the transaction, turn thousands of bad mortgages into giga profits, if only you believe that you can. Positive thinking is endemic to American culture, from weight loss programs to cancer support groups. And in the last two decades, it has put down deep roots in the corporate world as well. Everyone knows that you won't get a job paying more than $15 an hour unless you're a, quote, positive person. And no one becomes a chief executive by issuing warnings of possible disaster. the tomes in airport bookstores' business sections warn against negativity and advise the reader to be at all times upbeat, optimistic, brimming with confidence. It's a message companies relentlessly reinforced, treating their white-collar employees to manic motivational speakers and revival-like motivational events, while sending the top guys off to exotic locales to get pumped by the likes of Tony Robbins and other success gurus. Those who fail to get with the program would be subjected to personal, quote, coaching, or shown the door. The once sober finance industry was not immune. On their websites, motivational speakers proudly list companies like Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch among their clients. What's more, for those at the very top of the corporate hierarchy, all this positive thinking must not have seemed delusional at all. With a rise in executive compensation, bosses could have almost anything they wanted just by expressing the desire. No one was psychologically prepared for hard times when they hit, because, according to the tenets of positive thinking, even to think of trouble is to bring it on. Americans did not start out as deluded optimists. The original ethos, at least of white Protestant settlers and their descendants, was a grim Calvinism that offered wealth only through hard work and savings, and even then made no promises at all. You might work hard and still fail. You certainly wouldn't get anywhere by adjusting your attitude or dreamily visualizing success. Calvinists thought negatively, that's in quotes, as we would say today, carrying a weight of guilt and foreboding that sometimes broke their spirits. It was in response to this harsh attitude that positive thinking arose among mystics, lay healers, and transcendentalists in the 19th century, with its crowd-pleasing message that God or the universe is really on your side, that you can actually have whatever you want if the wanting is focused enough. That's it for this very short article. And first I want to consider this word optimism, because I think part of the problem here is how we define optimism, how we understand it. I'm going to turn here to a book called The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And this is by Greg Easterbrook. And he describes the tenets of what's called positive psychology. Positive psychology also contends that you are better off being an optimist than a pessimist. There's research that shows that as a group, the optimistic do better in life than the pessimistic, as measured by longevity, earnings, marriage duration, and other indicators. This does not mean become a Pollyanna. Optimists are actually better than pessimists in overcoming negative experiences because they can bounce back rather than be dragged under. Optimists, positive psychology finds, are not trying to dodge or deny the many objectionable aspects of life. Rather, they are employing mental strategies that help overcome the bad and improve the situation. In this thinking, it is in your self-interest to be optimistic. It is in your self-interest to be optimistic. And then he goes on to say, optimism can be instilled partly by training yourself to think positively. You know, I gave a Taisho not so long ago, maybe a couple years ago, about using what I refer to as cognitive interventions when facing adversity, when you're in facing things that have gone south for you in one way or another. One of the interventions you can use with yourself is to remind yourself that that it is one's karma, that one is expiating karma when things are, when you're facing hardship, when you're going through hardship. Even better than talking to yourself that way is just accepting it, completely concurring in the circumstances, the painful change that's happening. But a lot of people, certainly at times of hardship, aren't equipped to do that effectively. They don't really have the ability to just, with complete selflessness, concur with loss, let's say. And so then you get out other measures. You can tell yourself, okay, this is somehow, there must be some wisdom behind this loss that I'm experiencing. And it can work. It certainly can work. This, we get practice at this in our sitting, especially in sesshin, when one can dip so low in at times with a feeling of discouragement, and then can bring out the cavalry, which are the one that used to help me the most was the Japanese saying, seven times down, eight times up, such is life. These little things can lift one enough out of one's self-pity or discouragement that one can get a new purchase on one's practice and then pull out of that what is always a temporary state of mind. So cognitive self-talk can be effective. There's no question about it. And this is one way of understanding optimism, that somehow this is all, if not in my self-interest, self with a small s, it is in the interests of my furthering my development and getting beyond my self-interest, small s. Well, he goes on here. Among other things, positive psychologists and other practitioners of cognitive therapy teach patients to beware of the automatic negative thoughts that flit through the mind when unhappiness is coming on, and to counter such thoughts. It's common, for example, for those who suffer depression to experience an automatic thought along the lines of, "Here we go again," whenever something happens that resembles a cause of sadness from the past. Positive psychology teaches to fight the thought, "Here we go again." Instead, focus on how the new set of circumstances might turn out differently than the prior one. Well, it's hard to dispute the research, at least as far as it goes. So, this is, I don't think this is anything to be concerned about when employing these kind of devices that can neutralize what is a pessimistic reaction to circumstances. But ultimately, what in Zen or in Buddhism we would urge of all of us is to avoid both extremes of optimism. Everything will be, everything will turn out all right. And the other extreme is just pessimism. And what is between optimism and pessimism? Well, of course, it's realism. And realism, one aspect of that is what here in this book is referred to as learned optimism. By learning to expect tribulations and occasional blue periods, a person can avoid the sort of discouragement that engenders depression. Beginning in primary school, Seligman thinks, he's quoting this psychologist, children should be taught to anticipate difficulties in life. That way, when problems occur, as inevitably they will, children will not be traumatized, but see their need to deal with the problem as part of the natural course of events. Though positive psychology is positive, it opposes any idealized picture of life. Idealized expectations only foster disillusionment, whereas fully anticipating some really bad days now and then may foster a sustainably hopeful outlook. Managing one's approach to life in this way requires, of course, self-control. And that's where Zen practice comes in, learning to manage one's attention, learning to direct, knowing how, where to direct one's attention and where not to direct one's attention. This use of the word idealized is reminds me of what probably a lot of people are doing now with our new president, where he's become the repository of hopes and dreams and optimism and that have built up and been frustrated for many years now. And so let's look at Obama and his people and what we might expect. I'm speaking to a very, I think, an unusually wise group of people as far as the general population, relatively speaking. And my guess is that most people hearing this know better than to invest all their hopes in Obama fixing everything. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting, because sitting is the real testimony to self-reliance and not looking to someone, a daddy figure who can take care of everything for us. But it is very widely, very very common delusion as to look to the leader to fix everything. And this is part of the problem that happened after 9/11, when George Bush enjoyed this tremendous popularity. On September 10th, or 11th, let's say, September 11th of 2001, his popularity was, I don't know, in the 50s or something. And then on the next day, it was in the 80s. Now, what does that say about hopes and clutching at this father figure to protect us, and with the hope that he will manage to do so? Yeah, and so he loves to remind us that he did. We haven't been attacked since then. But at what price is the question? At what price? It is it is so exhilarating to have to hear a president, first of all, speak in complete sentences, but also someone who so far is not dwelling on this single issue of security and terrorism, war on terrorism, and all. There is a lot of reason to be hopeful by what we've seen in this man so far. But what we've seen is mostly his campaign. And as we all know, campaigning is one thing, governing is another. And that's where leadership can get very tricky, because you can't lead masses of people if you are too far out in front of them in terms of vision or, let's say, evolution. I don't know really how much substance there is to our new president. I think anyone who claims to know doesn't really know. They're really deluding themselves. Certainly he's given us a lot of good signs of how things can be changed, and that's wonderful. Let's be clear, he's a politician, and let's be clear about this too. He's not a full Buddha, so it would seem. If any of us who is not a full Buddha means that we have greed, anger, and delusion to contend with. His certain qualities of character are really exceptional. His detachment is what impresses me the most. His equanimity. Equanimity is the fourth of what in classical Buddhism is called the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes. The first of those is metta, loving kindness. Then comes karuna, compassion. The third is upekkha, which is sympathetic joy. That's mudita. And then the fourth, equanimity, is upekkha. And the fourth is considered the most developed, the most refined, where we weather the storms of life or the slings and arrows of our political opponents. We weather them by not reacting to the negative any more than we do to the positive. This is another lesson that we learn through practice, and again, especially sesshin. It's really the secret to having a smooth and rewarding sesshin, is to learn not to get giddy when our concentration is strong and thoughts are relatively few, nor to get disconsolate or discouraged when we feel frustrated in our concentration. I think already there are people, so I hear, who are experiencing some disappointment in Obama's appointments to his cabinet, and for his hewing more to the center than they might want. I think you can't really get anything done if you are too far to either end of the political spectrum. Unfortunately, because there were many things about the ideas of Denis Kucinich, for example, who's far more left, that I, f- found very appealing and very enlightened, informed. But imagine Denis Kucinich trying to get things through Congress if he held to those positions more out toward the margins of the political spectrum. So, you know, we're less than a week into the new administration, and we can register our concerns about positions or appointments by Obama that seem at odds with what we consider the center of the center, period. But I wouldn't want to be in his shoes with everything he has to try to accomplish. I think, speaking of this phrase, here we go again, it would be really not in anyone's interest if over the next few months we start to see more divergence from our political opinions, our political positions. We see divergence on the part of the Obama administration, and then our response is, oh, here we go again. I thought we were finished with this. This is pessimism. Here we go again. That doesn't do anyone any good. Now, to some real fundamental Buddhist principle, and that is the middle way. The middle way can be understood in any number of axes. In practice itself, the sitting practice, we could say that the middle way is avoiding the two extremes of straining on the one hand, in a grasping way to get something out of practice. Straining is one extreme. The other extreme is passive slackness in practice, where we just wait for everything to come to us. Those are the two extremes that many people have struggled with in practice. Many people have come and asked me, you know, what they should do when they try really hard, and then that doesn't seem to work. They get knotted up. And then they go the other extreme. They try sitting back and just hoping things will come to them. And that doesn't work. And the pendulum swings from side to side until, over time, if one can hang in there, it finds its way to the center. But the real classic Buddhist understanding of the middle way is what is this, the middle way between eternalism on one end, and nihilism on the other end. What do these words mean? Eternalism is a very philosophical, dry, abstract term for what could be rendered as belief in a self, an entity, a permanent self that acts to effect change. This is, of course, the conventional understanding of reality, especially in the United States, where the individual ego is seen as engendering all change. This is the notion of an agent. There's an agent in here, a little man in here, a fixed self that makes things happen. Well, to believe in that alone is delusion, because the truth is that there is no permanent fixed entity. The other extreme is to think that there is no responsibility at all that each of us has, that there's nothing we can do because everything is just chaos no self, no nothing. Everything just happens on its own. That's the other extreme. The experience of awakening reveals that it is neither of those by themselves, that each is sort of half of the truth. That yes, there is a kind of a self in that we have certain patterns, certain continuity in terms of our personality and character, and those traits, our character traits, our personality traits, can influence the world, or those around us anyway. But that's just a partial part of the whole process. The rest is everyone else and everything else. So, ultimately, in the ultimate side of things, that half of the equation, there is no fixed self called Obama, any more than there is a fixed self that each one of us is. There's no he there to make change in any absolute sense. Yes, in a relative sense. He can do a lot as president of the free world, so-called. He can do a lot. But then so can each of us in our own sphere, our own environment. Change does reside in each individual, each one of us, and all of us working together. And this is the hopeful thing, is that we can, each of us, as well as our president and his ministers, each of us can effect change and are responsible for doing so, and not just waiting for everything to come to us. That's the other extreme. But we mustn't get attached to the notion that everything can come from any one person, that it's all of us together, working together, as Obama seems to understand. Many people commented on how sober his inaugural address was, that there were no great soaring rhetorical passages, short on poetry. I thought it was perfectly appropriate for this time of real grave concern, financially and in other ways, especially financially. Any overly optimistic expressions on his part would have been at odds with the way things are. So there was gravity to his address, and that seemed perfectly fitting for this time. Notice how often he has reminded us, both during the campaign and in this past week, how it's going to get worse before it gets better, that we have to be adults here and expect that we've dug ourselves into such a hole, it's going to take a while to get out. And each one of us is responsible. Not only one of us, but every one of us is responsible for making that happen. I saw in the commentary about the night of the inauguration, there was a panel of very seasoned people on CNN or something, where one of whom was a black, a very prominent black minister, who cited a passage, cited a phrase that the president used in his address, where he said, "We must put aside childish things." And this is from the Bible. Don't ask me where in the Bible. This African American minister said the way he interpreted that was as a kind of code for the African American community, saying, "All right, enough complaining and blaming now. It's time, as this black minister said, it's time to stop sniping and complaining in the back seat of the car and get up in the front, be an adult, take the wheel, and drive things yourself." This is advice every one of us can take. Ezra Pound said, "A slave is a person who waits for someone to come and set him free." Obama, through his inspiring example, is someone who understood that and who didn't do it, didn't wait, but took matters in his own hands his whole life. The reason that the Kennedy, the most often quoted statement in John Kennedy's inaugural address, the reason it has persisted so long is because of the truth in it, where he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." That has survived over these decades as the most noted statement of that whole address, because we all recognize, at some level of the mind, we recognize that we are the country. We, the people, need to get beyond our own self-interests and figure out how we might serve the common interest. Obama himself will be changed. There's no fixed entity there. He will be changed. All of his advisors will be changed. We will be changed in the coming years. There's only change. I think we're best served if we understand optimism not in just getting one's way. That's what may be what many people think of as optimism. But in optimism is in the way itself. That is, optimism at its best really means faith. Faith, again, not in just getting what one wants, but in faith in the nature of things. That whatever is happening to us, including these big losses in the financial markets, in our own investments, losses of people close to us, breaking up in relationships, having people die. Faith means nothing if it doesn't mean having faith that there is some intelligence behind all this. There is some fundamental wisdom that all of this is reflecting in some way that we can't explain. This is the way in which Zen and Buddhism can be understood as a religion in that element of faith. Everything seems to be spiraling out of control. We're having a financial meltdown. We may, in a year from now, next January, we may be looking back at this time now as the golden age. You know, things were great in January 2009. So we must draw on something from something deeper than our own self-interest and what we can acquire or hold on to. And we even need to go, ultimately, we need to go beyond hope. Hope, it's natural enough at times to hope. I hope I get there on time. I hope that hope it doesn't rain on the day of the picnic. Okay, fair enough. But dwelling in hope, clinging to hope, is just another, it's another thought then. We're caught in another thought, another delusion. We're missing what's happening because we're thinking of the future. That's what hope is. It's a thought about the future. T.S. Eliot said, "I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope of the wrong thing." The wrong thing, because it's hope with a core of thought and self-interest around it. It is our being, and ultimately not our doing, but our being, where the greatest good from the greatest number will happen. I read this passage from Meister Eckhart, one of the Christian mystics, in Sesshin recently. I want to read it again. "People should think less about what they ought to do and more about what they ought to be. If only their being were good, their works would shine forth brightly. Do not imagine that you can ground your salvation upon actions. It must rest upon what you are." This is a fundamental premise in Zen, that no matter what changes happen in our systems, our political systems, our social systems, that this is not the way to any ultimate freedom. It is what our systems, but people. It is changing our relationship to others, our relationship to our circumstances, that determines not only our own well-being, but the wider well-being of all people. And that begins with purifying the mind and the heart. And that's something we can do. We don't have to wait for the government or anyone else. Each one of us has that tremendous power to empty the mind, to cleanse the mind of our own grasping, our own narrow self-interests. Gandhi said, you must be the change you wish to see in the world. It won't do to just hope that people will act less selfishly. Hope, what is that? It's being that less selfish one. And having patience. I have to confess, I'm worried about when, you know, Obama asked for patience, everyone's asking for patience. We don't, I mean, as Americans, we don't have a good track record with patience. We want everything now. We want the quick fix. There's let's hope there is no fixed entity called America or any country or any as any more than there is any one individual. So maybe we are changing in that regard. Certainly we're changing. There is no fixed country or person. We are change. Let's hope that that we have changed enough, we will be changing enough, that we can find the patience to endure the consequences of what has been put into place over many, many, many years, and well before the Bush administration. We have been misusing our minds, we've been misusing other countries and our own people for so long that there has to be a reckoning. And, well, it's already begun. It's just in financial terms. It may play out in other ways, too, and that's where we have to, again, draw from our faith that somehow it is nothing, is not a mistake. I want to close with some wonderful words by Wallace Stevens, who wrote a poem I read in Sesshin called The Snowman. But he said, after the final no, there comes a yes. On that yes, the future of our world depends. So we don't have to be silly optimists thinking that everything is going to go our way. That's beside the point. Our way, our wants are really beside the point. But we don't have to be optimistic in that negative way to not be pessimistic. There's just this world of causation, the cornerstone of Buddhism. And not to get lost in thinking about all this too much. I've used a lot of words today, as always in Taisho, but it's only in hopes that everyone, all of us, can be turned back to ourselves. The answer to all of these trials, the answer is not outside us. It is within us. And in terms of what we can do to bring forth that wisdom that is our nature, to bring that forth, we have Zazen. Not looking outside to the president or other people, but turning the mind around and facing ourselves, each one of us, as the that which we have some control over in terms of change. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.